Thank you. Good morning, agus fáilteas teach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. I am thrilled to welcome to This Irish American Life Dr. Robert Collins. Robert teaches at the University of Limerick and he works as an adjunct professor at Syracuse University in London. He has published several articles on the themes of modern Irish American history, but my opportunity to speak to him today is in the context of his brand new book. It's called Noraid and the Northern Ireland Troubles, 1970 to 1994. It's published in the last few weeks by the Four Courts Press in Dublin in Ireland. First of all, Robert, welcome to This Irish American Life, and thank you for coming on today, and congratulations on the book. It must be a relief to be at this part of the publication process.
Thanks, Miriam, and thanks for having me. Yes, it's been a little while coming. I'd like to think it was pretty quick after my PhD and my doctoral thesis to get the book out, but every time it felt like it was just about to come out, there was a bit of a delay. So delighted that it's finally out there in the world, I guess, for people to critique and enjoy.
You've turned it around, I think, in record time. If my research as to when you did your PhD, and you're putting me to shame because I'm someone who's 15 or more years out with no book out of their dissertation. But that brings me to my first question to you, Robert. This wonderful, it's a really important intervention in terms of our understanding of Irish diaspora nationalism in the United States in particular, and our listeners to This Irish American Life are going to find this a fascinating read. It stems, I believe, from your doctoral research, so would you mind telling us a little bit about the origins of what is now Noraid and the Northern Ireland Troubles book?
No problem. So it actually started my interest in kind of Irish history and the more modern Irish history actually started in my second year of university here in Limerick, where I took a class with, I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with, Dr. Rona Donnell, who works in the University of Limerick, and he subsequently became my supervisor for my doctoral thesis. But he teaches a class on the modern Northern Ireland Troubles. I attended one of his lectures, and when he speaks, you can't help but he speaks with such kind of passion and interest in the topic that I kind of felt a little bit inspired, and I didn't really know a whole lot, to be honest with you, Miriam, about Irish history, or particularly 20th century Irish history. It's not really taught much in schools here. I would certainly argue that more listeners with Irish American ancestry would probably know more about our country's history than most of the students who come through the system here. But that aside, so I became really interested in what had happened in Northern Ireland, and more specifically what had happened in Derry in 1972, and of course that's a chapter in the book on Bloody Sunday. And so I wrote about that for my final year undergraduate thesis. I wrote about Bloody Sunday and what had happened in Derry in January 1972 and the awful scenes there. And a section of that was the international responses. So I just kind of looked a little bit of how the because it was one of the kind of first real televised events of the Troubles, and it was in the context of, you know, the Vietnam War, etc. So it became very, it became you know, broadcast in the United States, and so that was my first interaction with NORAD or Irish Northern Aid. So I had a conversation with Dr. Rune O'Donnell about what I'd written and what I was interested in, and we just had a back and forth conversation, and he had asked me, was I interested in doing a PhD? And of course that was totally out of the realms of possibility for me. You know, I didn't think that a PhD was, you know, in my future or anything like that. But we just sat down and had a conversation, and I just said that I was really interested in learning more about Irish Northern Aid, and maybe about the Irish diaspora, the Irish American community, and how it maybe it's perceived versus what it actually is like. And with conversations with Ruin, I realised that they were an organisation that hadn't really been researched at all, and I guess, you know, no time like the present. So I was surprised to see that no real academic study had ever really been done of an organisation who were, as you said, an important organisation who had played such a key role in publicising the conflict to America and raising millions of dollars, etc. So I became really interested in that, and then I wrote the doctoral thesis and passed the VIVA examination in right during the first COVID lockdown, actually, in Ireland. So it had to do it all virtually. From then, I just started reaching out to a couple of publishers to see, because one of the strategies that me and Ruin had done during the writing process was that he told me I should write it, and it was great advice at the time. He told me that I should write it for a general audience. So write it so that anybody who was interested in the topic or interested in Irish history or Irish American history or the Irish diaspora could just pick it up and read it. And that can be quite tricky, as you'll know yourself, Miriam, from the doctoral process, but it was great advice. So once I finished that, I had to add some sections to it, to the thesis, just to make more sense in terms of the dates, in terms of some of the topics I was talking about, and then just reached out to publishers, and was very fortunate that within 12 months a publisher liked it and we signed a contract, and then it kind of the editing and that process was ongoing for the last 12 months or so, and then I was delighted that I was able to bring it out, kind of launch it in the last couple of weeks, but that it came out and was available in September. So that's kind of a long-ish answer to the question.
No, it's great. No, it's great. It's actually great to hear the mechanics of that process, especially for any budding historians or writers in general listening in. I think that was very sound advice from Ruin to kind of think about it in as the most accessible kind of format. I think too often we get in these research projects, we can get a little bit too bound up in the theory and the methodology and everything, but it kind of doesn't work that well with a wider audience. You open the book, Robert, with, and maybe this was a part that you added in from the dissertation, I'm not sure. The book itself opens with a kind of sweeping overview of aspects of diaspora nationalism United States context from Wolf Tone onwards. Tell us a little bit about how you situate the story as you pick it up circa 1970 in that longer trajectory of the history of American influence and activism and, I suppose, activity as it pertained to Ireland's situation in the British Empire as it was?
Great question, yeah. So the reason I used 1798 as a starting point, because that's kind of seen as the beginning of Irish separatism or Irish nationalism, or the belief certainly across the Atlantic that Ireland would be better off as an independent Ireland. So I started there, but of course, you know, immigration from Ireland to the United States had started much before, in earlier in the 18th century, and had been a feature, unfortunately, of Irish life really right through from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So kind of I decided to start with Wolf Tone and the Society of United Irishmen in 1798, because of course Tone himself, I spent some time in America in the lead up to the rebellion in 1798, and also you have several of the leaders of the United Irishmen come to the United States at the turn of the 19th century, and they bring with them, including Robert Emmet's brother, Thomas Addis. Of course, Emmet had his own rebellion in 1803, but So you have a situation where you have people emigrating from Ireland in the 19th century who were coming over to America and are finding, you know, the New World, etc. But they're also not forgetting about Ireland and that tradition of... So they kind of build from there. And then obviously I chart in the book a little bit. I talk a little bit about Daniel O'Connell and the repeal movement and the Catholic emancipation in the 1820s and how that was supported in America, albeit even though O'Connell himself was a critic of Emmett and his rebellion. So you have that in the 1820s, and then, of course, I mean, I probably wasn't able to give it enough justification in the book because there are several books written about the significance of An Gairt Mór, the Great Irish Famine of the 1840s to 1850s, to how that impacted. I mean, I mentioned figures in the book, and they're not exactly agreed upon by all historians, so that's important to say, but that we probably have somewhere between 1 and 2 million Irish people emigrating to the United States between the years of 1845 and 1855, which represents, I think, somewhere around one third or over 30% of total immigration to the United States during that period, which for such a small island nation like Ireland is very, very significant. So you have a situation, but more importantly, when it comes to the famine period, you also have a huge uprising in almost anti-British sentiment and anti-empire ideologies within several kind of key figures who come over from Ireland to the United States. John Mitchell, a very good example. So you have that situation where you almost have that kind of Irish nationalism almost being hardened in the United States by the circumstances, not only that face Irish people when they arrive in America, but also because they feel as though they've been displaced. And I think a book, as I said, some listeners, and I'm sure you're familiar with yourself, Miriam, by Kirby Miller about immigrants and exiles, and he talks about that notion of nationalism or you know, sharpened by exile, or emigration as exile. So you have that kind of tradition to America. And then obviously as you see upper mobility within the kind of Irish American community, you see, you know, maybe that doesn't necessarily be the case for all of you know, the Irish people who emigrate to America, but then you have that tradition continuing in the 20th century. You know, you have the provision of funds and support coming from America, from Clanmiguel, from the Fenian Brotherhood before that, for campaigns that are happening against Britain in Ireland, and the Dynamite Campaign in the 1880s, of course, in Britain. And then you have a huge amount of financial support for the 1916 Easter Rising. I understand that I'm breezing very quickly through very key events in Irish history, but just to get us up to the 1970s. And you also then have, you know, significant support from Irish America during the War of Independence in 1919, 1920, 1921. And then obviously you have the Civil War, and really the formation of a lot of the key figures in NORAID are born out of several individuals who would have fought in the War of Independence, who would have taken the anti-treaty side during the treaty negotiations and during the Civil War, and then would have emigrated to the United States in the 1920s and would have arrived over in America and found refuge in the local counties associations, in the Gaelic Athletic Association, the GAA, within Clanmiguel, who would have supported more militant Irish nationalism. And they kind of formed the backbone of Irish Northern Aid when the outbreak of conflict happens in Northern Ireland in the late 1960s, that you have that backbone of the Irish American community who had emigrated themselves several years before that. So that kind of tradition of maybe arriving in America and obviously trying to build a new life, but also being very conscious of events that are happening in Ireland, particularly for those of immediate Irish lineage or ancestry who never really forget about their... And I think that would be the experience of a lot of your listeners, Miriam, and would have been, I imagine, your experience when you're looking at Irish diaspora, not just nationalism, but just Irish diaspora in general, that kind of interest in events that are happening in Ireland.
You bring out what I think is probably significant, and correct me if I'm wrong, that generation, say that 1920s generation, as we kind of loosely refer to them in terms of the, you know, kind of waves of migration, Irish migration in the 20th century, and I suppose the first significant one after partition and after the Civil War and the War of Independence and everything. For that generation, and you're saying that some of these are key figures in terms of the founding of NORAID later on, they had a kind of either personal, as you say, or a very close kind of connection to a very tumultuous time in Irish history, right? And you'd have to think that really plays a role in terms of their perceptions of Ireland's status as it evolved in that period, and, as you say, kind of how that's then coupled with their
even if you don't fully lean into the kind of exile, you know, kind of trope, but, you know, that sense of like being away from Ireland and what you can do to contribute to the conversation in terms of, you know, activities and things like that from outside of the island, right? So that kind of, I suppose, not just the coincidence, but the timing of when these people are kind of come of age, right? And as you say, come to the United States. And I suppose then from that, Robert, 1970 isn't just some coincidental date in terms of the emergence of NORAID. Can you, I'm guessing that that is oxygenated or given kind of energy out of what's percolating and, you know, like not to use too inappropriate a term, kind of what is exploding in terms of Northern Ireland in the late 1960s. Can you, for me and for the listeners, Robert, maybe contextualise the immediate lead up to the founding of NORAID, if you don't mind?
The kind of interest in Irish America as to what's happening in, particularly in the Northern Irish state, of course, which is formed with the Government of Ireland Act in 1920 and had gone on largely unabated and, in terms of the unionist majority and the issues around discrimination of the Catholic minority population in Northern Ireland had largely gone on until the 1960s, when obviously you have the outbreak of kind of a more, well, it wouldn't necessarily use the word national, but a more united civil rights movement in the mid-1960s, of course, pushed by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, or NICRA. And there is some interest in Irish America with the civil rights movement, and there are organisations that are formed in the late 1960s. Two that are significant, the American Congress for Irish Freedom and the National Association for Irish Justice. Now, the American Congress for Irish Freedom is an organisation that some of the key members that then form NORAID actually join the ACIF, and they are involved in civil rights and supporting the civil rights movement, but they're also just generally Irish Americans who are interested in what's happening in Ireland. But once you see the escalation, I guess, in tensions and the arrival of British troops in 1969 in the aftermath of the Battle of the Bogside, you see suddenly a real spike in interest suddenly in Irish America, because now, you know, you could imagine, Miriam, for a lot of the as you said, the 20s generation, to use that term, they're suddenly seeing the arrival, I guess, of British troops back onto Irish soil, of course, who many of them would have fought against in the War of Independence. So they would have seen this as a shocking development. And then, of course, you have and one of the key events that precipitates the formation of NORAID is the split in the Republican movement, or the Irish Republican Army in Ireland in late 1969.
Oh, really? I never knew that.
Two strands, the Provisional IRA and the Official IRA. And once the Provisional IRA, who are seen as the more militant of the two in terms of their intent in engaging in armed conflict against the apparatus of the state, they turned to America, which had been a tradition before, and as I said, the prisoner, and they turned to America to set up a fund to aid the families of prisoners, because they anticipate an armed campaign that's going to lead to several, obviously, you know, prisoners, and then those families are going to need support. And that tradition, Miriam, had been there before, so it wasn't that something new necessarily, in terms of that there was prisoners' aid funds set up in the aftermath of the 1916 Easter Rising. There was a prisoners' aid fund set up in the 1920s to support the IRA during the War of Independence, and also there had been a smaller one set up in the 1950s to support when the IRA had participated in a border campaign and attacks on the border in Ireland between 1956 and 1962. There was a fund set up in New York, but it didn't achieve any. It's similar to the campaign itself. It didn't achieve significant financial gains or significant prominence in America. Really, just kind of in the New York metropolitan area. That's all born out of tradition. So then when the leaders of the Provisional IRA turned to America, they turned to the key figures from the 1920s, because they had established themselves within the Irish American community as people with what I would call unimpeachable credentials, in terms of that they had fought in the War of Independence. For example, the most well-known founding member of NORAID is Michael Flannery, and Flannery had been a messenger boy as a teenager during the Rising, had fought in the War of Independence and had seen activity, and then had fought on the anti-treaty side during the Civil War, and then emigrated in 1927 to New York. So people like that were looked upon by the Frisian IRA to set up funds because they were very aware of what was happening in Ireland and had kept, I guess, abreast at what had happened, what had been happening in Ireland all through. So then when they felt as though they needed, I guess, people who could you know, set up an organisation that would gain some traction, they turned to people like Flannery, who, as I said, had supported the need for armed conflict in the 1920s and continued to do so in the 1970s. So they're the kind of activists who formed the backbone of NORIB, and it's formed in the kind of springtime in 1970.
Fascinating. I never knew that NORAID had kind of come out of that split in terms of what had happened in Ireland. That's really, really interesting. Michael Flannery is a name for some of our older listeners. They'll be, well, some of them will have known him. Can you tell us a little bit about his role more generally, Robert, in terms of as a kind of key figure that I gather, you know, was one of those kind of mobilizing forces around some of these activities over many decades? Can you give us a little bit of a portrait of him in that context?
Yes, and I, for some of the listeners and some people I've interviewed who have known him, I probably won't be able to do him justice, but I'll talk a little bit about kind of the key role he played within the Irish American community, particularly in New York. So Flannery is somebody who, once he arrives in New York, I believe in 1927, and he settles in Jackson Heights and becomes a insurance agent for, I believe, the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And Flannery, when he arrives in America, becomes very heavily involved in your traditional Irish American organisations, but he also becomes heavily involved in Clan na Gael and becomes their head by the late 1920s, and is also very involved in New York GEA. And I believe, and I'm sure some of your listeners might be able to correct me, but I believe he served as a delegate for New York GEA over and back to Ireland for several years, and was very prominent within as somebody to support, and is somebody, of course, who, being born on the Tipperary-Offaly border, I believe, my understanding is he saw himself as a very proud Tipperary man. But he becomes an important figure because when NORAID are formed, they need somebody who has already established themselves well within the Irish American community, and somebody who is a very recognisable name and figure, and Flannery does fit the bill. And although there are several other ones, like Jack McCarthy and John McGowan are also founding members with him, who are also well established in the Irish American community, but Flannery plays an important role to start, because he, as I said, is somebody who, and I think I spoke about this a little bit in the book, is he's somebody who has, and I use that phrase again, he has strong credentials as somebody, as I said, who had been there and done that in Ireland, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he was going to have a very good understanding of what it took in order to support an armed conflict, having participated himself. So he certainly wasn't going to be, you know, and I think it was a common theme throughout the book, and we may touch on it again, Miriam, but, you know, Flannery certainly couldn't be accused of being a, you know, misguided Irish-American who had no knowledge of Ireland and simply romanticised the idea of Ireland. You know, this is somebody who was born and raised in Ireland and had seen, I guess, Ireland at its, you know, at its worst during the Civil War, you know. So he wasn't going to be somebody who was simply going to look maybe with a flowery notion of what was happening in Ireland and what was happening with conflict. So he was somebody who, I guess, the leaders of the Provisional IRA trusted, and somebody who they believed could get an accurate message across about the need, the justification and need for, I guess, for a turn towards the armed struggle. And Flannery was somebody who played a key role in that and continued to play a key role in NORAID, somewhat probably usurped later on by other more vocal figures, but continued to play a key role in the organisation really until he left in 1987, and continues to play a huge role in the Irish American community until his passing in I believe 1994, in the mid-1990s. So he's somebody who was a name that came up a lot when I was, you know, researching the book, when I was speaking to some people who were involved, you know. So he's somebody who clearly was very, very well respected within the Irish diaspora.
Going back to your own interest, what, you went into it a little bit, but was there, like, it's a big commitment to undertake a research project, which, you know, happily now has culminated in a book, but was there something in particular, like, how familiar were you with Irish American history and things like that? Like, what was the hook that kind of drew you in, if you know what I mean? Because it's not necessarily, you know, I'm kind of, I think, wired like you. I find this history really, really interesting, especially when it's put in dialogue with Irish history and the island of Ireland, if you know what I mean, which is, I think, something that you're doing as well. But was there a particular angle of it, or suppose it's kind of the hook that kind of drew you in terms of like embarking on the journey, which led to you, you know, not only doing the historical research in terms of the documentary sources, but as you referenced there, interviews as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, really, to be honest. I've thought about it myself. I think it sounds, you know, like I would say for me, my interest in Irish America was born out of the fact that having, you know, visited the States myself as a child, and I have two uncles who currently live in America in San Francisco. So like, I was always kind of interested in America as a country. And so that would have been necessarily before I knew much about like Irish America and the importance of the Irish American community and et cetera. So I was always interested in America, and I then became interested in, as I said, after attending the lecture, I became interested. So the hook was really Irish history, and particularly Northern Irish history. And then from that, I just became really interested. The hook then for me was that what is happening over in America, and who are these individuals who are living over in America, 3,000 miles away, but are almost more knowledgeable than most of the island of Ireland about what's even happening in Ireland, and how is that happening? And I guess I always was interested, I guess, in sometimes the portrayal of Irish Americans on the island of Ireland in terms of terms like misguided and ignorant, and, you know, the famous, you know, negative stereotyping of Irish Americans. And I was always interested in that, and I don't really know why, to be honest with you. And then from there, I just suddenly became immersed in the world of Irish America. And to be honest, and I'm very keen to point out when it comes to the book, about the book being a starting point, is that I realise, as somebody who has come into this history very recently, like 5 years, five or six years ago really is when I really started researching, you know, Irish America and the Irish American community, is that I've just really enjoyed it every step of the way. I've really enjoyed the process of it. I like researching, which I guess probably makes me very unique. And I just, from there, I guess, so it's hard, difficult to point maybe at one thing. It's just once I was in it, I couldn't see myself ever researching anything else. And I'm sure maybe that's the same for you, Miriam, but once I had started, what the spark was, I'm not sure, but once I'd started, I realised that learning more about Irish America and meeting people who, you know, who lived through the conflict on both sides of the Atlantic was just something that motivated me to learn more about the history and to write about it. So it kind of, once I started, I couldn't help but immerse myself in it, I guess.
And can I ask you then, Robert, and I totally take your point, and a lot of my own research and the work that is done at New York University, where I've had a long-standing connection, is animated around trying to add some more nuance to Irish perceptions of Irish America, in particular when it comes to political things and everything. But I'm sure you also as well at the same time encountered a sense of Irish and, you know, Irish American perceptions of Ireland being at a distance in a kind of, in a negative way, like in terms of like not sometimes keeping up with, you know, kind of what's going on the ground. Did you find that at all in your work, and how did you kind of balance that out?
The reason I used NORAID as the central focus and then worked out from there is that within NORAID you have the activists who are very up to date and very knowledgeable about what's happening in Ireland, and have a really good, solid and good understanding and caring for what's happening in Ireland. But obviously one of NORAID, and that became interesting for the book, one of NORAID's almost, their primary objective was to, you know, to raise money and to support the Republican movement in Ireland, but almost their secondary objective became kind of trying to educate the Irish American community so about what's actually happening in Ireland, and not to have just a very singular view or a very, you know, distant view or very or a non-nuanced view, I guess, of what's happening. So there is that element of that, and I think that's probably what allowed maybe the authorities, when a lot of scrutiny is being placed on the 70s and 80s, to just simply dismiss the organisation as a bunch of Irish Americans who have no knowledge of what's happening in Ireland and are simply just getting involved because they're Irish, or because you know, they're only Irish on St. Patrick's Day, you know. So I think my advantage with the research was that I was very much dealing mostly with people who, you know, who were involved in NORAD, etc. But certainly through the research, you find that there's certainly an element as well of, particularly in the aftermath, I would say, of the hunger strikes in 1981, is you have a lot of newer members or newer people who are joining NORAD who really don't have the grounding in Irish history and in the understanding of Ireland that maybe the older activists within NORAID would have had. So you have maybe a situation where NORAID as an organisation themselves are changing, and that kind of solid foundation of a really solid understanding is kind of dissipating somewhat. So there's certainly that element as well, and it's not to dismiss that. It's just that I very much wanted to focus my research on those who were keeping abreast, I guess, of what was happening in Ireland, whilst also being very aware that there is, you know, maybe a larger community who are maybe not understanding the nuances of what's actually happening in Ireland.
I know I didn't ask you that now to in any way diminish your strategy. I totally appreciate that, Robert. I was just interested to hear about how you kind of squared that away, and it totally makes sense as you explain it, as you kind of leaned into those kind of, but I used, like, I looked at activism in the run up to the Easter Rising, Robert, in a project a few years ago, and, you know, kind of zoned in on one particular activist, a female doctor called Dr. Gertrude Kelly. I kind of used her example and others to kind of label, and she's active in a kind of a different way to some of the primarily men who you're looking at in your context. But I called her, and I think, I don't know whether this word would work for you in terms of some of your individuals, like brokers, you know, and I think Michael Flannery is a good example of that. They're people who have an intimate knowledge of Ireland, usually by virtue of them being born and raised there, although not exclusively. You find, I think there are actually good examples that defy or buck that trend in terms of an Irish American example here and there, and then there are people who have an intimate knowledge of the American setting, right? So in the context of, as you explain, the development of NORAID, going out to the States in terms of looking for that support and needing figures who are kind of able to kind of translate the cultures back and forth, if you know what I mean. I don't know whether that makes sense to you, Robert, or if you'd kind of agree with that kind of rough kind of definition.
I do, and I can give you an example actually of an exception in a second, but I do think so as well, and I do think that's, you know, two-dimensional and it's back and forth in terms of the fact is that the people in Ireland, of course, who are, you know, if they're in the leadership of the Provisional IRA once the split happens, are people who are veterans, you know, who are long-term activists, who are long-term, and they obviously feel more comfortable when they come to the States to meet, you know, people like Flannery who, you know, are from Ireland themselves, and maybe they would have felt much more alienated had they met maybe a different strand of the Irish American community, who maybe wouldn't have that fundamental grounding within Irish history and within even just attitudes and traditions of growing up in Ireland, you know, that are different obviously to growing up there's differences between growing up in Ireland and growing up in Irish America, of course. But the interesting one was that NORAID almost intentionally in her early years cultivate that image of being very much Irish born, being very intimate, and that somebody, the kind of person who becomes a figurehead later, I interviewed him several times for the book, Martin Galvin, who of course would be familiar to some listeners. Of course, he is an Irish American who I guess bucks the trend, but the way I think he's able to do so is that he's regularly over and back to Ireland, and that he uses somebody like Flannery as his mentor. In one of the interviews, Galvin describes Flannery as his mentor, so you can see Irish Americans maybe somewhat bucking the trend, but that generally only happens if they have some mentorship, or also if they're just over and back to Ireland quite a lot, because once you go over and back and get to meet the people that are involved, maybe you get more of a grounding understanding. And I think that's probably why, for example, and it's a chapter in the book, why NORAID institute the tours where they bring Irish Americans to Ireland, to Northern Ireland, to see to meet the people, and to see the conditions there. They start that in 1983, so very much trying to maybe get that grounding almost, or almost manufacture it by bringing Irish Americans to Northern Ireland in order to let them see it for themselves. Because, you know, in the early years of NORAID, they didn't really have to concern themselves with whether people who were joining were familiar with Ireland, because, of course, most of them were Irish born. Whereas in 1980s, you have much more joining who may have never even been to Ireland. Their parents may not have been to Ireland. And that doesn't necessarily make them less Irish or anything like that, but they may not have a familiarity with what Ireland in the 1980s looks like, for example. So that's why I think one of the motivating factors for why they decided to do the tour is maybe just to add that kind of familiarity with Ireland to NORAID activists, so that they have that understanding in the American setting, but also that they can maybe get more of a feel for what's happening in Ireland.
Can you tell us a little bit about the reverberations of Bloody Sunday in the American context in terms of the orbit of, I suppose, a nascent NORAID, you know, a fledgling organization then? And then just under a decade later, I know from some of my own work that the 1980-81 hunger strikes were very, very well documented and closely followed, not only in an Irish-American context, but actually in a broader context. But from the drawing on your research for the book, Robert, can you maybe tell us a little bit about responses or the context of how those events were responded to in the networks you're looking at?
And I'll deal with Bloody Sunday first. And you're quite right to point out, Miriam, that as a fledgling organisation, NORAID do almost, because one of the themes of the book, and it's not disparaging towards the organisation or towards the Irish American community, but they are quite reactionary to what's happening in Ireland. You know, that because they're, you know, the particularly activists within NORAID are keeping up with what's happening in Ireland, that they tend to get large spikes in support in response to what's happening during the conflict, which is why the book tries to get the balance between writing about Irish history, because you can't write about the history of Irish America or NORAID during this period without writing about Irish history, but also it's not an Irish history book, more so because my expertise is in Irish America. But within that context, then Bloody Sunday becomes the first major event for NORAID. So for the first 2 years of existence, you have the Falls Road curfew, the curfew that was placed in the summer of 1970, which kind of shifts maybe British, the feeling within the nationalist communities about the British Army and about what their purpose is in Northern Ireland. But it isn't a large televised event in the way of Bloody Sundays. And then also you have the introduction of internment in August of 1971. But even then, that's a slower process in terms of, you know, you don't have one major event within internment. You do have the early pickups, but in August 1971. So Bloody Sunday becomes the first large scale, this is an event that you can focus on, and the scenes and the such atrocities that were carried out on that day. So in the aftermath, I think Flannery, and it's actually the title of the chapter in the book, that Flannery describes the event as NORAID's first big publicity break, I think was the quote. So it became this huge event that, you know, they held protests, marches, demonstrations across New York, in other major cities as well, I'm sure, particularly Irish American cities, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago. In New York, you have a huge protest at the British consulate. You have NORAID raising conservative estimates, you could pray, even in the 1970s, probably $1 to $2 million in the year after Bloody Sunday, which is a colossal amount, given that in the 2 years before Bloody Sunday, they probably wouldn't have raised even half, anywhere near that amount. So you have a huge, and Bloody Sunday allows NORAID to grow as an organisation, so it allows them, for example, to set up, it gives them some of the funds that they use to establish a weekly newspaper, the Irish People, which, of course, some or many of your listeners, Miriam, will be familiar with the newspaper because it had a long print run until the 2000s. So, you know, it allows them to do that because it's no coincidence that it's less than 6 months later after Bloody Sunday that the newspaper is founded. And obviously a weekly periodical is a significant undertaking for an organisation. And also you have them now holding larger socials. So they have their big, large annual testimonial dinner that they start a year later in 1973. So Bloody Sunday becomes the first major event that allows NORAID as an organisation to grow into, I guess, not only just nationwide, but also just to boost their numbers in terms of, you have new chapters appearing across the East Coast, which is where NORAID has most of their strength is on the East Coast, although, you know, there are exceptions, as I mentioned, Chicago and San Francisco. And then the hunger strike period, so you have somewhat of a, I don't know if lull is the right word, but once you have kind of the atrocities on in the 70s, and you have the long war strategy that's been operated in terms of smaller events, you know, have large scale events in Northern Ireland. So you have kind of a bit of a lull in support maybe for NORAID in terms of, you know, they don't have that marquee event to point to. And then you have the advent of the hunger strikes in 1980-1981, which obviously is the culmination of the prison protest that starts in 1976 with the removal of special category status. So you have in the first hunger strike kind of breaking out in 1980, but the key thing for NORAID was that once the announcement of the first hunger strike happens, NORAID begin to build infrastructure across the United States. They set up what are called Irish Prisoner of War Committees, and actually at the launch, at the Belfast launch of the book last week, Fran McCann, who was an activist and a former blanket man himself, he spoke about these committees himself and recognised them when he toured the United States for a couple of months in 1980. And the first hunger strike allows Norway to build the infrastructure and the interest in what's happening, you know, because the hunger strike is quite a, you know, a serious, you know, form of protest, obviously. So aids them in able to get the point across to the Irish American community, or even just the American, as you mentioned, just the American community at large, about how serious the events in Northern Ireland are, that you have these people willing to, you know, starve themselves to death in order just to simply get, you know, political prisoner status. So the first hunger strike obviously ends in uncertainty in December of 1980, and then you have the announcement of the second hunger strike with Bobby Sands on the 1st of March 1981. So then you have the situation where Norway have already built the kind of infrastructure and interest up, so that once the second hunger strike happens, and obviously it becomes clear that British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher is not going to cede to the prisoners' demands, and the hunger strikers start, you know, deteriorating significantly in health, you have Norway capitalising by holding large demonstrations, socials. They actually bring over relatives of hunger strikers during this period. So they bring over Bobby Sands' brother, Sean, after Bobby had passed away. They bring over Patsy O'Hara's sister, Liz O'Hara, who of course lived in New York at the time, and several other family members to speak at Norway demonstrations, at functions, raise money, publicise the conflict, etc. So you have a situation where almost the conflict is front page news across the United States, you know, and Norway, as the most militant supporters of the Republican movement in Ireland, are gaining support because of that. So they raise again huge amounts of money, but it also allows them to grow in size and stature again in terms of you know, new chapters. There was, you know, there were various references to new chapters being formed or chapters being reformed in the aftermath of the hunger strike, and you just have this explosion of publicity. And 1981 is a little bit different, than, I think, to 1972, just because of the more availability of broadcast print media, of, you know, television, things like that. So you're able to get broadcasts out to a larger audience in 1981 than you probably are in 1972, which means that Norred are able to broadcast, and the hunger strikes are more drawn out, you know, it's a longer period, mm-hmm. you know, because the hunger strikers are dying at different times and they're staggered. So you have a situation where, you know, each death is being greeted by mass protests, mass demonstrations, you know, and almost pleading for support. So you have both events being huge, and that's why they're both chapters in the book. But you have the reactions within the Irish American community are similar between both of them, but in 1981 you could certainly argue that it's larger, just because Norred were able to build the infrastructure and the support network and the support base and the publicity in a much greater volume than they probably were in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday.
Oh, that's really fascinating, Robert. You're being very generous with your time here. I'm hoping you won't mind me squeezing in one or two more questions. And the point isn't lost on me that we're right around the time now of the centenary of the death of Terence McSweeney on hunger strike. So that kind of recurrence of the hunger strike as a kind of motif and a modality of protest in terms of the British Irish geopolitical situation, it's interesting that we just happen to be around that anniversary here as we talk about it. Chapter 6, I have two more quick questions, Robert, and I hope we're not taking up too much of your time here. It's really, really a treat to have this opportunity, and I encourage people to pick up the book and dive even more into these fascinating topics. Chapter 6 of the book is called Irish Northern Aid and Sean Downes, An Unlikely Connection. Can you give us just a quick kind of snapshot of what you mean by an unlikely connection and the context of Sean Downes and NORAID?
Sean Downes himself is a young man living in West Belfast who is a bricklayer, I believe, by trade, who attends a demonstration in 1984 that ultimately ends with him losing his life. And the context around that is that I mentioned it earlier in the interview, Miriam, about that NORAID had instituted tours of Irish Americans, bringing a group of Irish Americans to Northern Ireland. And it had been jointly organised by NORAID and Sinn Féin, and Tom Hartley of Sinn Féin was heavily involved in that, in the organisation of that. And they came up with the idea that they would come to Northern Ireland. They would originally, the tour would arrive in Dublin and they'd visit sites like Kilmainham Jail and Glasnevin Cemetery, places like that. But they would then travel up to the north, and they would stay with a host family usually a Catholic or a nationalist family. But the culmination of the tour was always that they hold a, or they held certainly during the conflict, they held a demonstration against internment every year since it was instituted in 1971, even though the policy of internment had ended in practical terms in 1975. They still held a large demonstration every year in Belfast, and it was a demonstration against internment. So in 1983, they held a large one, and the NORAID touring party, and they weren't all NORAID members, but they were the ones helping to organise the tour. They attended that demonstration, and it was very good publicity, I guess, because, you know, you're seeing these large demonstrations, large numbers, and they're speaking about it. So, but then in 1984, the decision was made that Martin Galvin, who had organised the tour in 1983, he was going to be excluded from entering the United Kingdom, and that they were going to put a ban on him from coming and heading up the tour. So he was banned from entering, and I write a little bit about the decision and the complications around it in the book, so I won't necessarily go into too much detail with the listeners. But basically, so Galvin, and as he spoke a little himself about interviews, he makes the decision, either pressurised by Sinn Féin or himself, he makes the decision to come to Ireland and come to Northern Ireland and speak at the march against the demonstration against internment on the 12th of August 1984. And as Galvin is taken to the podium, so he's snuck in and he takes to the podium, and the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police force, they rush the crowd in order to try and arrest Galvin, and a riot breaks out, and Downs is shot in the chest with a plastic bullet and killed. And the reason, and it becomes an international story because, you know, it's publicity, and it's you know, there's lots of blame on lots of different sides once the event happens. But it's another example of, you know, the the Irish American community are coming over to Ireland, is precipitating this event, and then you have a large scale riot, and what most people, even the police involved, would describe as such an unnecessary death and event. But the reason it's almost, I use the term an unlikely connection, is that, you know, Downs and the names Sean Downs and Martin Galvin are inextricably linked probably forever because of what happened that day, even though, despite the fact that they've never met each other. I know that Martin and the FFAI, Freedom for All Ireland Committee, have been involved in Sean Downs' widow calling for a new public inquiry into his death. But just that the organisation, that NORAID and Downs are almost linked in a way that you would find hard to believe unless you read the chapter in the book to make the connection between the two, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that event, I guess, became international news in a way that so many other killings, I guess, that happened during the conflict didn't. And
right.
Probably because of the fact that NORAID were and their publicity director was there, that made it an international event and made it an event of circumstance. Not that, of course, all deaths, you know, during the conflict were of circumstance, but that this became an international event just simply because of that.
That's fascinating, Robert. Can I just ask you, I'm conscious of time, you've been more than generous, but the McBride principles form another chapter. For the benefit of some of our listeners who may not be as au fait, tell us a little bit about what's involved and the significance, I suppose, as it pertains to NORAID as we close out our interview today, Robert, if you don't mind.
The interesting thing about, so I'll tell you a little bit about the principles themselves, and then I'll talk a little bit, and I think I make the point in the book that the actual campaign itself was much more important than what was actually contained within the principles, but I'll talk a little bit about that. So the McBride principles were an idea that basically, because there was employment discrimination existing in Northern Ireland, you know, there was demonstrable, and that even though there was a Fair Employment Act, which I think had been initiated in 1974, that, you know, that there was no possibility for discrimination, but it was pretty evident, and Irish America had been heavily involved in actively lobbying or highlighting the fact that employment discrimination existed in Northern Ireland in key areas like manufacturing, in the docks, for example, and in some of the key, and also in some key American multinational corporations, like Ford was a very good example, but there were others, that General Motors, things that had examples of, you know, that it was obvious that the Catholic population were simply not equality when it came to applying for jobs. So it came up, so it was very much pushed by the Irish American community. Organisations like the Irish National Caucus, NORAID were involved. They came up with an idea for the McBride principles. Now, the McBride principles are named after Sean McBride, and Sean McBride has the surely unique achievement of being the only person I can think of who was a former IRA Chief of Staff and also Nobel Peace Prize winner. He became involved heavily in humanitarian work when he became part of the Irish government in the 1930s, 1940s. So they used his name for the principles, they were basically a set of affirmative action employment principles, the idea that, you know, that you would put pressure on American multinational corporations who had businesses in Northern Ireland, had business and plants in Northern Ireland, that they would agree to implement policies that would improve standards and also chances for the Catholic population to get jobs and to get promoted within employment. Now, they were pretty mild, you know, that they weren't calling for, you know, reverse discrimination or anything like that, but interesting was they were rejected immediately by the British government because no raid were involved, you know, and they constantly used the idea that, you know, that because no raid were involved, there must be a sinister angle to it. So what became interesting was that even though McBride principles weren't necessarily calling for a whole lot, they were challenged very vehemently when they were attempted to be passed through the various state legislatures in the United States. Like, I use New York as the example in the book, and how hard the authorities, British authorities, fought against and lobbied against the McBride principles being passed into law in New York, which of course they subsequently were, but that they helped, and the Dearey Flynn bill was key in 1985 to precipitate them with bright principles, but that they fought the campaign really, really hard. And it just became another example of an idea that, which the concept came throughout the book, is that once the idea that for the British authorities, that once, and actually almost the Irish authorities as well, and the Irish embassy were involved in lobbying against McBride principles, that once no raid were involved, it had to be resisted, regardless of whether it was a good or bad thing for Northern Ireland or the people of Northern Ireland. So one thing that became interesting about the McBride principles is that the campaign itself, because a new Fair Employment Act was introduced in 1989 in the UK and Northern Ireland that alleviated some of the challenges, and there's still challenges being faced, you know, by the different communities in Northern Ireland in terms of employment, but that they introduced a new Fair Employment Act. And the McBride principles were never really going to realistically change a whole lot, because, you know, you could bring in the policies but then not actually implement them. So it became very interesting that the campaign itself probably became more important, and then once it caught steam in America, I think it got passed in over 20 states. So it became, the campaign itself, I would say, became more important than the actual implementation of the principles themselves. And they also, it almost acted as a microcosm of NORAD's involvement within the conflict, in that it, often if they supported anything positive or negative when it came to Ireland, that it was to be resisted by the British and Irish authorities simply because NORAD were supporting it.
Fascinating stuff, Robert. Thank you for sharing these insights with us today on this Irish American life, and congratulations again. The name of the book is NORAD and the Northern Ireland Troubles, 1970-94. It's published by the Four Courts Press. I hope you keep up with this kind of research, Robert, and thanks again for coming on to this Irish American life.
Well, thanks for having me, Miriam.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.